This is Marcia McCormick, and this podcast covers Congress's power over the jurisdiction of the federal courts. Article 3 defines the scope of the judicial power, and it gives Congress some power to control jurisdiction of the federal courts. The extent of that power is subject to some debate. Article 3 provides that the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. It goes on, the judicial power shall extend to cases of a certain type and to controversies involving certain parties. In all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. In all the other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. There are three possible views of the scope of Article III's grant of power to Congress and the grant of jurisdiction to the federal courts. Article 3 could be a floor, a ceiling, or both. A floor only. If Article 3 is the floor, then Congress must vest the federal courts with all of the jurisdiction mentioned and may grant jurisdiction over more cases and controversies. A ceiling only. If Article 3 is a ceiling, then Congress may not grant the courts with jurisdiction over anything not mentioned in Article 3, and it does not have to vest the courts with jurisdiction over all the things that are mentioned. Both a floor and a ceiling. If Article 3 is both, then Congress must vest all of the jurisdiction in the federal courts, but may not vest more than what Article 3 itself calls for. So what's the answer? Clearly, Article 3 is at least a ceiling. Marbury v. Madison treated Article 3 as a ceiling on Congress's power, at least as it related to the Supreme Court's power. Since that time, the courts have consistently done so, except in a couple of rare situations involving specialized courts and the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. So, it's well settled that Article 3 is a ceiling, but not clear whether it might also be a floor, or at least a floor for some matters. As a matter of historical fact, Congress has never granted the federal courts full Article III jurisdiction, and Congress has occasionally removed jurisdiction over certain issues or topics after it had initially granted it. The grant has been done usually through the blanket grant of federal question jurisdiction, and then a specialized statute carves out a particular type of case, removing jurisdiction. There is one exception, though, to this, and that is for the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction. It is generally agreed that the Constitution itself vests the Supreme Court with jurisdiction over the items it has original jurisdiction over, and Congress has gone along with that for the most part. The one variance is that Congress has given the lower courts concurrent jurisdiction over some of those matters, and the court has acquiesced in that practice, really embracing it, especially as we've grown bigger as a country, and it has become harder for the court as an institution to hold anything like a trial. So when I talk about jurisdiction stripping here, I'll be talking only about the jurisdiction of the lower federal courts and the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. Every term sees jurisdiction stripping legislation introduced in Congress, and some has passed. As part of the New Deal, Congress took away the power of the federal courts to enjoin labor stoppages. More recently, Congress has curtailed jurisdiction over civil rights and habeas litigation by inmates in state and federal prisons, appeals by immigrants involved in immigration proceedings, and habeas proceedings by detainees classified as enemy combatants by the government. At the same time, Congress has considered whether to strip the federal courts over, for example, challenges to state laws regulating abortion, challenges to the words under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, and challenges to the definition of marriage in the Defense of Marriage Act. These subject matter-focused and more controversial kinds of jurisdiction-stripping legislation have not passed. The purpose of jurisdiction-stripping is usually either to lighten the dockets of the federal courts or to influence the outcome of the particular kind of case. The Prison Litigation Reform Act, which limits civil rights litigation in federal court by prisoners, was created in large part to lighten the dockets of the federal courts. The Norris-LaGuardia Act, which took away the federal court's power to enjoin labor stoppages, was designed to change the substantive outcome of those cases. The federal courts were interfering with workers' ability to use the one economic weapon they possessed, and Congress wanted unions to have the full power to use that weapon. State courts at the time were not granting those injunctions, and so removing the power of the federal courts meant that work stoppages were not enjoined very often. The constitutionality of Congress's power to strip jurisdiction has not been resolved. Usually, when specific provisions have been challenged, the federal courts have not been completely shut out, and that fact has allowed the courts to avoid the harder constitutional issues. And while this issue may not seem very important to the average case, the issue is very important to our political system, and it arises multiple times every year. As I said, jurisdiction stripping legislation is introduced into Congress every year, and the primary reason it rarely becomes law is congressional and presidential doubt about its constitutionality. Let's turn to the arguments about that constitutionality, and we'll separate the discussion into the arguments about limiting lower court jurisdiction, Supreme Court appellate jurisdiction, and all federal court jurisdiction. We'll touch briefly on the power to remove all federal and state court jurisdiction in connection with discussion of the other topics, but that is especially problematic. As a constitutional matter, it seems that there are a number of possible outcomes on the scope of Congress's power. 1. Congress may have plenary or total power over the lower federal court's jurisdiction. 2. Congress may have plenary power over the Supreme Court's appellate jurisdiction. 3. Congress may have plenary power over one, but not the other. 4. Congress may have limited power over both, and that limited power might come from A. Article 3 itself, including constitutional values like separation of powers, checks and balances, federalism, uniformity of federal law, supremacy, etc., or B. Other constitutional provisions. Let's turn first to the power of Congress to limit lower federal court jurisdiction. The proponents of that power argue that because Congress has the power to not create lower federal courts at all, it has the lesser power to create them, but to give them less than all of the jurisdiction that Article 3 provides. This view is strongly supported by the Supreme Court's numerous cases acquiescing to Congress's power to withhold jurisdiction, beginning with Sheldon v. Sill, a case about Congress's ability to define diversity jurisdiction more narrowly than Article 3 does. Proponents also argue that the language in Article 3 that allows Congress discretion to create lower federal courts was a compromise, and to not recognize Congress's power here ignores the intent of some framers that there be no lower federal courts at all. Opponents of lower court jurisdiction stripping argue that once Congress did create the lower federal courts, it did not have the power to limit their jurisdiction, but had to vest all of the judicial power in them. This argument comes from the text of Article 3, which provides that the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and such inferior courts as the Congress may establish. Additionally, Article 3 provides that the judicial power, quote, shall extend to, end quote, the cases and controversies it identifies. This argument is weakened so severely by historical practice that it's no longer tenable. Congress has never vested the lower federal courts with full Article 3 jurisdiction, and to say after more than 200 years that this is unconstitutional is not very persuasive. What's more acceptable to argue is that Congress need not vest all of the jurisdiction of Article 3 in the lower federal courts, but once it has vested some jurisdiction, it may not selectively exclude certain constitutional topics from lower federal court review. That argument is consistent with Supreme Court precedent. Additionally, some argue that the existence of lower federal courts is constitutionally required for some types of claims, and so they attack the initial premise that Congress has plenary power to decide whether to create lower federal courts at all. This argument relies on the language that the judicial power, quote, shall be vested, end quote, in the federal courts, together with the language that puts some categories of cases outside of the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction and outside of state court jurisdiction. In other words, Congress had to vest the whole judicial power in some federal court, but allowing the Supreme Court to retain appellate jurisdiction over the issues would not be enough if there was no court to appeal from. Some cases cannot be heard by state courts, but also are not within the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction. Supporting that argument, some have said that Article 3's use of the word all before the list of types of cases the judicial power extends to shows that the federal courts have to have jurisdiction over at least those kinds of cases. Others have argued that given the passage of time and our reliance on a federal forum for constitutional claims, Congress could no longer abolish the lower federal courts, even if it could once. And having lost that power, Congress cannot limit the jurisdiction of the lower federal courts to only certain topics. Finally, some argue that lower federal courts are necessary to serve as a check on the states, at least after the 14th Amendment, which shifted power from the states to the federal government and especially the federal judiciary, was ratified. There's one last argument on what limits there might be to Congress's ability to limit lower federal court jurisdiction, and that is that Congress may be able to limit the jurisdiction of the lower federal court significantly, but cannot do so in a way that would violate other constitutional rights, for example, in a way that would deny due process of law, equal protection, or some other right. And in fact, denying any court jurisdiction to review constitutional claims probably would deny due process. The Supreme Court has been careful never to confront that issue directly in statutes that seem to preclude judicial review by interpreting those statutes not to preclude all review, and lower federal courts have followed that lead. One of the arguments raised in support of plenary power to control the lower court's jurisdiction is that the Supreme Court can have appellate jurisdiction even without lower federal courts by reviewing state court decisions. So what about Congress's control over the Supreme Court's appellate jurisdiction? Again, there are two sides to the scope of that power. And like for the lower courts, the sources of argument on both sides are the text of the Constitution, precedents, and policy considerations. The textual argument to support Congress's authority to limit the Supreme Court's jurisdiction comes from that language in Article 3 that says that the court, quote, shall have appellate jurisdiction, comma, both as to law and to fact, comma, with such exceptions, comma, and under such regulations as Congress shall make, end quote. This provision by its terms seems to allow Congress broad power to limit the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. Proponents of this view argue that this power is an important check on the judicial branch. The textual argument for opponents of Supreme Court jurisdiction stripping focuses in part on the rules of grammar. They argue that in the text, the word exceptions modifies fact, since it comes right after that word, so that Congress can make exceptions to the Supreme Court's appellate review of issues of fact only. Supporting that argument is the argument that the Federalist Papers clearly demonstrate that the framers were concerned about the Supreme Court's ability to overturn fact-finding by the lower courts, especially when done by juries. Another argument is that even if the exceptions clause does modify appellate jurisdiction, the framers couldn't possibly have meant that the exceptions could be so broad so that there is nothing to have appellate jurisdiction over. That's more than an exception. And a third textual argument looks outside of Article 3 to the rest of the Constitution. Congress would not be able to limit jurisdiction in a manner that violates other provisions of the Constitution, and so Congress probably could not restrict appellate review of all cases in which male litigants prevailed over female litigants. This might also mean that Congress could not remove Supreme Court appellate jurisdiction over any constitutional issues. Precedents support both sides also. Ex parte McArdle supports jurisdiction stripping. In that case, remember, Congress repealed the statute that gave the Supreme Court appellate jurisdiction over McArdle's habeas petition after the case had been argued before the court, and it did so with the express purpose of frustrating the court's review of that particular case. The court found that it lacked jurisdiction over McArdle's case because Congress had created an exception within its Article III power. Opponents of Supreme Court jurisdiction stripping argue that in McArdle, the court noted that it still had authority to hear habeas cases under the Judiciary Act of 1789, but that McArdle hadn't pled that act as the source of jurisdiction, and by the time the Supreme Court's decision, McArdle had also been released from prison. And thus, Congress wasn't stripping all habeas jurisdiction from the court. Additionally, in Ex parte Yerger, the Supreme Court confirmed that it had authority to review habeas corpus provisions under the Judiciary Act of 1879. More recently, the Supreme Court has confirmed that there is more than one avenue for habeas relief in the context of the Anti-Terrorism and Death Penalty Act, and it is this avenue that saved that strip from being unconstitutional. Given that there are arguments from the text of the Constitution and Supreme Court precedents on both sides of the Supreme Court jurisdiction stripping debate, let's look at the policy arguments. Proponents of Supreme Court jurisdiction stripping argue that the power is an essential majoritarian check on the judicial branch. Opponents of Supreme Court jurisdiction stripping argue that the judicial branch cannot be independent in its interpretation of the Constitution if the Supreme Court is always subject to a legislative check. Many constitutional provisions are anti-majoritarian. In other words, although passed in a supermajoritarian fashion, they operate to limit the power of the bare majority to oppress political minorities. Additionally, opponents argue that stripping jurisdiction from the Supreme Court will not operate as a check on the court's power because the old precedent will still exist and cannot be changed if the court can't consider the issues any longer. And if the states do not respect the prior Supreme Court precedents, essentially if they ignore the Supremacy Clause, jurisdiction stripping will have undermined the legitimacy of the Constitution in all areas, including those parts empowering the legislative and executive branches. Thus, opponents of jurisdiction stripping argue that Congress lacks the power to restrict Supreme Court jurisdiction to the point that it undermines the court's essential functions of ensuring supremacy of federal law and interpreting the Constitution. If Congress could enact a law but strip the court of jurisdiction over the constitutionality of that law, Congress could completely defeat the judicial branch check. As a practical matter, it is unlikely that Congress would ever be successful at defeating the check provided by the judicial branch, since the federal courts retain the jurisdiction to decide whether they have jurisdiction in any case. Thus, the courts will always have the power to interpret the Constitution to protect their place in the scheme of checks and balances. Proponents respond to this essential functions argument by going back to the text of Article 3 to say that the power to alter the check is not unconstitutional since the text of Article 3 would allow it. To assume that the court must always operate as a check in one particular way goes too far. The Constitution itself, by its terms, provides for a way to frustrate the operation of the judicial check. The bulk of this description has focused on removing jurisdiction for either the lower courts or the Supreme Court. What about for all federal courts? That is monumentally more controversial than just one or the other. The sources for argument are the same, and I won't reiterate them here, but the policy arguments against allowing Congress to do something like that are much stronger when all federal court jurisdiction is at stake. I'm sure you can see how the arguments related to separation of powers and supremacy of federal law become especially strong if there are no federal courts. All of these arguments were tested by the litigation brought by detainees held by the U.S. military in the course of our war on terror, and the court confirmed that the detainees had to have some access, at least equivalent to habeas review, to the federal courts. That to not provide for that level of independent review was an unconstitutional suspension of the writ. So at the very least, the court has most recently affirmed that Congress cannot strip jurisdiction from the federal courts in a way that would violate some provision of the Constitution outside of Article 3. This ends the Jurisdiction Stripping Podcast. Thanks.